I'm Christopher Lydon. This is The Whole Wide World, and it should be dessert time. We've been talking this hour about what we eat as a story about the fate of the biosphere. We began with a cautionary observation from the celebrated ant scientist E.O. Wilson that the human species, like none other, is a geophysical force single-handedly and catastrophically affecting the web of life all around us. I asked Ed Wilson to put his stethoscope on the planet.
We're in the early stages of dangerous revolutionary change in every aspect of the environment. Global warming, for example, if it continued, and now there's not any much reasonable question that it is ongoing and that it could have major effects within the next 50 years. We're in the early stages of it. If we kept pushing it, allowing it to proceed, then it could become truly catastrophic. We're in a very early stage of wiping out the rest of the world's biodiversity. It's gone farther than many people realize. For example, in some parts of the world, of the 125 species known of birds that were native and unique to the Hawaiian Islands, when the first Polynesians put shore, I believe around 400 AD, including a native eagle and a flightless ibis and a giant goose-like form, remarkable, you know, the dodo of Hawaii and so on. Of those 125 species, about 25 are left, and of those, most are endangered, some critically so. But in other parts of the world, we still have intact rainforest, sufficient, and some grasslands and ancient deserts, which if protected would allow us, I think, to save most of the species, but not if we continue with conversion, logging, agricultural conversion and pollution at the rate that we are inflicting on the planet now, and inflicting it at an accelerating rate. I don't think any one of the major oceanic fisheries today is at a sustainable level. That is to say, all of them now have been skimmed off.
You're talking about global warming, a crash of species, exhaustion of the fisheries. Continue the list.
Well, one that's going to bite us sooner than most people realize is the shortage of fresh water, potable water, water adequately clean for irrigation.
There is a food crisis implied there, but what E.O. Wilson worries about is not sufficient calories to feed 6 or even 10 billion humans with the lands under cultivation.
What alarms me as a biologist is this. The natural environments in which most of the plants and animals of the world hang on, the reservoirs, the parks, the remaining tropical forest wildernesses and so on, are shrinking rapidly because the expanding populations are simply taking them over to produce more food and reach more water. We're in a bottleneck of overpopulation, rising per capita consumption all around the world. And the idea is to get through that bottleneck, but carrying as much of the rest of life with us as possible, not just human life, but all of life through the bottleneck. If we find ourselves in a biologically impoverished world where everything is human chains and with far fewer kinds of plants and animals and natural environments that can take care of themselves around the world, I think that we, our descendants, humanity, generally, will deeply regret that something wasn't done to avoid that fate.
On E.O. Wilson's list, and many others, the fresh water supply is high among the life and death emergencies now facing the planet. Water, since it's mostly used to irrigate crops, is another name for food. Grain shipped from wet countries to dry countries is sometimes called virtual water. In clouds overhead and in aquifers underground, water is an absolutely vital resource that overflows national borders or international custody. Sandra Postel runs the Global Water Policy Project from Amherst, Massachusetts. I asked her what part of the food problem is a water problem and what part of the water problem is a food problem.
Water and food issues are very, very connected. 70% of all the water that we take out of rivers, lakes, underground aquifers is for irrigation. It's to grow crops. 70%. So agriculture accounts for the lion's share of the water that we're extracting from the natural environment. On flipping that over, if you look at the food side, about 40% of the world's food comes from irrigated land. And so on the food picture, we're very, very dependent on the availability of water to secure the food supply. And what we're beginning to see now around the world is that when you look at the most important irrigation zones in the world, particularly China, India, Pakistan, and the Western United States, which are the four top irrigators in the world, you see very serious signs of unsustainable water use in just about all of those important irrigated areas. In addition, we see major rivers running dry in the important irrigated...
Like which ones?
We're seeing the Indus River running dry, which is a very important source of water for Pakistan, and Pakistan relies on irrigation for 80% of its food production. The Yellow River in China has been running dry on and off since 1972, and it's been running dry for longer stretches of the year throughout the 1990s and into this decade now. The Ganges River in South Asia, these are major rivers that are overtapped even today.
You're talking about unsustainable water use in major breadbaskets of the world. What happens next? I mean, when does the crunch come and how?
Well, that's a very good question. In addition to the rivers being overtapped and groundwater being overpumped, we have salinization of the soil, which historically is one of the biggest unsustainable uses of irrigation water. The fact that as you use more and more irrigation water, salts build up in the soil, particularly in very dry climates. And something like 20% of our current irrigation base is suffering from the buildup of salts in the soil. So we have these three major things happening in much of this irrigated base around the world. The United States can get by because we have a very rich agricultural base in other parts of the country, but many countries cannot. China, India, Pakistan, much of Asia is very, very heavily dependent on irrigation for their food supply. And, you know, this is where I think the major crunch will come. Asia has 60% of the world's people, but only 36% of its fresh water. And so it'll be in the countries in Asia, I think, where we see this unsustainable use of water, the increased pressures on water, really come to bear on food supplies.
Water is a measure of that great threat to the biosphere, the climate change that's already underway, the global warming of which Professor Wilson says there's little doubt, the meltdown and flooding that Jared Diamond was worrying about at the start of the hour. The journalist Bill McKibben was one of the first to write about the scientific study of global warming and to put it in every man's language.
So far, the temperature's gone up about 1 degree Fahrenheit on this planet due to human intervention. That's been enough to, thin ice in the Arctic by 40%. It's been enough to make winter at my latitude on average about 3 weeks shorter. Just to give you some example, you're sitting in Boston right now. The new computer modeling indicates that by the end of this century, middle to end of this century, the climate of Boston is likely to resemble the climate of current-day Atlanta, Georgia. If that's all that happened, that would be fine. People can survive in Atlanta, Georgia. But all that extra energy expressing itself in a million different ways around this system, you know, higher wind speeds, more melt of precipitation, more melt of ice, more precipitation, you know, every possible variable on the face of the Earth except tectonic and volcanic forces will be thrown into some kind of disequilibrium simultaneously.
Global warming and food production, it goes almost without saying, are just a link or two apart.
civilization and agriculture have evolved simultaneously over the last 10,000 years, and they've done it in a period of relative climatic stability. One of the things you've been able to count on in that 10,000-year period is that if you could grow potatoes or wheat or something in a particular field, your great-granddaughter would be able to do the same. That's now a complete sucker's bet. By radically changing climate, we introduce an element of instability into this system that's truly unprecedented. Take rice. It's grown in great many cases in low-lying parts of Asia, in parts of Asia that are close to the sea. I was in Bangladesh year before last, one of the great rice-growing cultures of the world, because it's on this, you know, magnificent river delta where the Ganges and the Brahmaputra pour down out of the Himalaya into the Bay of Bengal. And each year there's this nice gentle flood, and it leaves behind this layer of silt, and everything's incredibly fertile, and the rice just, you know, three times a year they're able to triple crop rice, and it explodes out of the paddies. Here's the problem. One of the things that happens when you raise the temperature of the planet is you raise the level of the ocean. Well, if you raise the level of the Bay of Bengal a couple of feet, that water pouring down out of the Himalaya sort of runs into a plug when it reaches the ocean. And instead of a nice gentle flood, you get dire, devastating floods. They had one like that in 1998, in the warmest year on record in this planet. And you know, something like two-thirds of Bangladesh was under thigh-deep water or better for the better part of 3 months. Now, you know, on the one hand, they coped with it a lot better than we would cope with it. You know, people moved up on the roofs of their huts. They fished. There was much less whining than you know, encounter in greater Boston from the average snowstorm. On the other hand, they didn't get their fall rice crop in that year. They weren't food self-sufficient like they usually are. By many estimates, the number of environmental refugees in this century, primarily people who can no longer grow the food they need to grow on their land, will exceed the number of political refugees in the bloody century we've just come through.
So what is the chance that this is the way the world ends, not with a bang or a whimper, but, as it almost did in Noah's day, with a flood?
Global warming is more a condition almost than a particular a problem. You know, very few people are going to die from global warming, you know. But as you warm the planet, you make you set the ground for all these other problems. For instance, who likes a warmer, wetter world? Well, the clear answer is mosquitoes. So, you know, the World Health Organization has said that dengue fever is going to be the breakout disease of this century. I, in my usual avant-garde way, managed to contract it while I was in Bangladesh a couple of years ago, and can testify that if this is the vanguard disease of the century, it's not going to be much fun. There were a lot of people in Bangladesh who were dying while I was there, and dying in some, you know, in some measure because we can't get our own, you know, consumption under control. All those sort of things, from food shortages to violent weather episodes, all of those things are underwritten by this most basic change in the conditions of the Earth. Here's the way to think about it. Into this narrow envelope of atmosphere, we are adding a lot more energy, many watts per square meter of the Earth's surface. That energy will express itself in an enormous number of ways. The violence of the Earth, the physical ferocity of the Earth and as we encounter it, will amp up in enormous measure. A world that we have managed to thrive on, that we've managed to grow to 6 or 7 billion people on, a world that has been, in essence, taken as a whole, benign, gentle, and hospitable to us, is vanishing. to be replaced by a world that we know very little about, but that every indication we have will be a far less pleasant place for us to hang our hat.
What sticks to my ribs at the end of this hour, this mixed meal of environmental reflections, is E.O. Wilson's optimism and E.O. Wilson's anxiety. When all else fails, he says, quoting Abba Iban, men turn to reason. The other saying goes, we are what we eat. Ed Wilson's worry is that we'll get more and more like what we're eating, especially those farm-fed salmon who never swim the oceans, or the penned-up steers fattening in their sprawling slums of beef. Ed Wilson's pretty sure that we humans can save our species, but if we do it at the expense of other life around us, our offspring could be living on life supports like Frank Perdue's warehouse chickens, and they'll be cursing their free-range ancestors who heedlessly killed so much of the old habitat. Every meal henceforth can be a moment to remember our engagement with living nature. As Julia Child says, bon appétit. Please visit our global community online at thewholewideworld.net. The Whole Wide World is a collaboration of Leiden and McGrath Productions and the Berkman Center for Internet and Society at Harvard Law School, in association with WGBH Radio Boston. We had help from producers Ben Walker and Catherine Bidwell, from engineer Tom Tiger and Jake Shapiro of the Public Radio Exchange, Jay Allison of Transom.org, with support from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, is our radio visionary. Thanks also to Keith Kyle Wilson, Justin Grotlucian, Keisha Parsons, Josh Ward, the Christian Science Publishing Society, and public radio stations WCAI and WNAN on Cape Cod. Support for this program is made possible in part by the PRI Program Fund, whose contributors include the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation. Mary McGrath is our executive producer. I'm Christopher Lydon.
PRI, Public Radio International.